Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1352, we feature two stories by new Life Rattle writer, Sue Bracken. Sue Bracken was born in Toronto in 1953. Although she has lived and worked here for many years, she has also had many tangents. She worked as a physiotherapist on Harley Street in London, England, in various pain and sports clinics, and currently works in health and safety for a municipal government. On a more soulful level, Sue has danced professionally in Toronto and unprofessionally in London, England, cycled in Scotland, swam in Haliburton Lakes, had cheese fondue while camping by the South Saskatchewan River, and written poetry whenever she could. She is inspired daily by her fabulous partner's artwork and their fabulous son's music. They make Sue want to be a better blues mandolin player. Perhaps from her experience writing poetry, in her prose, Sue Bracken conjures images that swim rhythmically around the reader. This quality, paired with her ability to craft dialogue that parcels each moment perfectly, creates stories that vibrate with life. In tonight's first story, a woman, not quite over the loss of her canine companion, finds herself almost coerced into welcoming another dog into her life when she allows the dog of a friend to break through her lingering grief. Let's listen now as Sue Bracken reads her story, Dog Gettin', tonight on Life Rattle.
Dog Gettin' by Sue Bracken. I just can't handle another dog right now. Exasperated at having to explain myself again, I continue. It would feel too much like a replacement, I stumble. I can't handle the vet bills, the loss of independence, the constant vacuuming, or the guilt. There, all the reasons. I sigh and look over at Dave. It's his turn to cook dinner, and he cooks like the artist he is. Blues master Luther Allison calls out full blast, and Dave responds in kind. He's a happy man. The music plays full tilt. Unique spice combos float in rhythm. Dave chops with precision and in time. I sigh again. Dave, am I being too selfish? He takes a break, sips his stout, and smiles at me. No, it's fine, Sue. No one's pushing. Well, that's not exactly accurate, I say over Luther's stinging slide solo. What about Lori? Luther and Dave belt out the chorus together. My lower decibel question isn't heard. Our good friend Lori fosters puppies in Toronto for a puppy rescue group. The dogs are flown out of Attawapiskat to a farm in Moosonee with the hope of finding good homes elsewhere. These northern dogs have a reputation for being intelligent and well-behaved. If they're not, they're shot. Hence the rescue mission. Lori is also intelligent and usually well-behaved. Plus, she is a highly effective and enthusiastic promoter of these puppies. Witness the 60 or so dogs in the High Park area that look suspiciously related. Sue, I've got just the dog for you, Lori said last time we met. Whenever you're ready, just let me know. Look, Lori, you've got to stop this. I didn't mean to growl. It's pulling my heartstrings right out of their ventricles. Okay, okay, she raised her palms in mock defeat. It's just that you guys are such great dog people. I shot a warning glance. She retreated. A few months later, our friend Viv invites us over for Christmas dinner. Viv also has a spare heart chamber, but it's reserved for a herd of feral cats, untouchable felines. They wander constantly in and out of her house. This Christmas night is a bit of a human rescue event as well. Those saved from spending Christmas alone include Viv's elderly mum, her ex, their son, plus Dave and I. Also at this dinner is Viv's recently divorced sister and her 3-year-old newly adopted dog, Owen. There is a general cacophony in Viv's house, a symphony in an extended rehearsal. The bass is Viv's German husband. His deep voice resonates as he offers to top up libations all round. Viv's sis and mum form the string section, laughing, their clear Welsh accents ringing through the house. The percussion is handled by the ex and son, parsing the present relatives, both voices having broken to low staccato long ago. Viv is not just multitasking, but working the full Christmas triathlon, cooking, serving, and concurrently trying to enjoy herself. I grab her in mid-transit between oven and sink and wrap my arms around her. Thank you, Viv. She smiles and is off. Bits of family conversation roll over and into each other like waves. I'm setting up my mum's sound system and paying for the whole thing. No one's really sure how that drug works. More research is needed. Dave and I grin at that one. Viv's sister mentions that since being on her own, she finds her house too quiet. That's why she adopted Owen. For this night, Owen has been relegated to the guest room, a haven from the ferals, to entertain himself as only canines can. The guest room is situated en route to the washroom, a frequent flyer destination on this night. I doubt I am the only one who views the washroom as a place for soulful thoughts, silent conversations with questions and answers, or for a break from the night's activities. I'm curious about Owen, so of course I have to check in on him during one of these breaks. Hello, Owen. I open the door cautiously. We check each other out. Owen sits a little too formally, elevating his chest like a true foo dog. I lower myself to his level, extend my palm slowly, and wait. His tail goes from wag to thump. He licks my hand. Well, Merry Christmas to you too. Good dog. I'll bring you a treat next time, okay? I swear his lips stretch into a smile. I don't want to push it, so I leave and close the door behind me. I return to the static of simultaneous conversations at the dinner table. The friction I anticipated at this gathering, based on personal family experience, does not rear its head this Christmas day. Disagreements are choked mid-stride with more wine and food. Everyone behaves, a gift to each other. I mention the dog visit to Dave. The visits become pretty regular as the night progresses. Other dogs always remind me of Chaser, my first and only dog. When we got him, I read everything I could find in a quest to be a good dog person. What I learned is that the authors probably never had a dog. I'd read out the day's lessons for Dave. Hey Dave, fun fact. Did you know you should ignore your dog when you get home from work? I shook my head in disbelief. Imagine Chase at the door, tail in full twirl, his whole body vibrating with pure joy that we'd return to him, and then, I paused for emphasis, we're supposed to walk right by him, straight to, what, the beer fridge? The TV? I hurled the book at the wall. Who writes this garbage? We both laughed, patting Chaser, who sat between us on the couch. I also read that dogs liked hugs. I did not know that, but it was true for Chaser. I think about Chaser. I wonder about Owen. It's time for another visit. Sitting on the floor beside Owen, I slide my hand along his noble head. I reach below the satin of his ears. Gently, I place my other hand on his chest, and in a slow, continuous motion, I bring my hands towards each other. We are head to head. I can feel his heart strong and steady. We are still. Every memory of Chaser roars through me in high definition. Owen's friendly brown fur becomes Chaser's thick, elegant, charcoal black fur under my hands. The realization of how much I've missed Chase, the feeling of him, the privilege of such unconditional love thuds in my chest. I whisper, "Good boy, Wonder Dog." I pat this generous creature and head quickly back to the party, totally overwhelmed. I sit down beside Dave at the table. The guests, the accents, all the great food and wine fill the cozy back porch of our friend's home. Everyone toasts in unison to each other, to those who can't be here, and to Christmas. "How's Owen?" Dave asks. "Oh, fine," I reply. "Doesn't he remind you a bit of Chaser?" 2 days later, I sit in Dave's studio, talking over the holidays with him, as he puts finishing touches on a drawing. I know this will sound crazy, but I attempt to describe the dog hug to him. Dave smiles his all-knowing smile, pops a cork, and pours 2 glasses of Prosecco. "Cheers!" He smiles again and clinks my glass. Prosecco is a symbol of celebration in my family, not a vehicle of persuasion. However, I feel the chain links loosening. By the end of the conversation and another drink, I am miraculously phoning Lori. God love her, instead of a regular, "Hello," she answers with, "Hey Sue, you calling about a puppy?" "Yes, the cute one posing on your Facebook page." Lori deposits the puppy directly into my arms before noon the next day. He nestles his head on my shoulder, as adept at marketing as Lori. I lean my cheek against this head. Who is being rescued here? "You can always call me if it doesn't work out," Lori says through a wicked grin. "Christ, Lori," I almost bark. "You know it's a done deal." I am helpless. Dave names him Zephyr for the wind that brought him. Zephyr sits in our kitchen, warming in the heat of the winter sun, gold flecks sparking off his electric eyebrows. His gaze is a slow, wide awakening, looking at me, looking at him. Contact.
That was Sue Bracken reading her story, Dog Gettin'. Tonight's second story, though quite different from the first, also speaks to the complex emotions and the pain of losing a loved one. Into the difficult situation of 2 sisters making plans for a recently passed brother's cremated remains, Sue Bracken introduces an uncouth funerary professional whose callous behavior is enough to make you squirm. Let's listen now as Sue Bracken reads her story, section 21.
Section 21 by Sue Bracken. I don't picnic at cemeteries. I don't jog through them, and in fact, I try not to even look at them. Yet here I am on this summer Friday afternoon with my sister at a cemetery office. We are in these hallowed halls to add our brother's ashes to the family plot and to arrange for a monument to honor him. The office building is attached to the landscaping yard, shovels, dirt, and all. And it's raining. "Come on in," the office manager says, shaking our hands. Peter directs us to a back room, decorated with photos of open caskets on one wall and samples of various monuments on the other. "It's been a while since you've been here," Peter says. "A lot has changed." He opens our file. Your grandmother bought this double plot in 1937 for $500. If you bought it now, you'd pay $12,000. I try to read his expression, the slight lift of his upper lip. Your grandfather died in 1937 of myocardial infarction, he continues. We're not allowed to record the cause of death anymore. Is that for privacy? My sister asks. Oh, yes, top secret, you know. Peter rolls his eyes and sucks his upper teeth. In this plot, he continues, we have your grandfather buried extra deep on the east side. On top of him is P.F., who is your... He pauses, waiting for us to fill in the blank. Our great uncle responds, my sis. That's right, says Peter. And here's a diagram of the plot. He produces the paper with a flourish. The diagram, a rectangle containing three smaller rectangles, caskets, and two smaller squares, cremated remains, is about 2 inches by 3 inches. Mom and Dad are on top, here. He points to the small squares. I prickle at his familiarity with my parents. We didn't allow cremations in your grandparents' time. My sis follows Peter's identification of the residence at this address. She asks, the remaining room in this plot is one casket and two boxes, or just three boxes for the surviving heirs? She is the oldest of five siblings, and I'm the youngest. My sis, closest in age and heart to our deceased brother, has taken on the responsibilities of these details. No, that's three boxes for the three surviving heirs. That's your other brother and... He waits again for us to complete a sentence. My sister complies. That's us. That's right. We went over all this on the phone. Peter's voice rises in disapproval as he looks over my sister's head and out the window. His mouth is in perpetual motion. My sister's head is bent to her notes, so she does not witness the surreal quality of this moment. My sister looks at Peter. We'd like something simple for the monument, she says. Just our brother's name on it, and spaces for the names of the three remaining siblings. Peter swiftly pulls another paper from our file. When you were last here, he says, you ordered this monument to hold Mom and Dad's names and that of J.P., who is... His gaze moves back to the window as he waits. Our sister, we both respond flatly. That's right. Simple is fine, or you could have one like Father, with a border or not. He gestures grandly to the sample monument titled Father on the wall. The embellishments on Andrew, he says, directing our gaze further along the wall, cost extra. I've gone completely mute watching Peter's shifting face. His eyes only ever skirt mine, though surely eye contact is a prerequisite for this job. He pulls out another diagram. This paper shows the monument with four outlines, one with name and date for your brother, and space date, shown here three times, for future plans. He leans back, sucks his teeth again, and explains to the trees outside. The three space dates are not actually chiseled into the stone. Everyone gets confused by this. He pauses for effect before he continues. Will the three remaining siblings be buried here? My sister hesitates. I don't know. This time I look out the window. A bizarre conversation ensues about the placement of our brother's ashes and monument, the possibility of exhuming the extra deep caskets, and of not finding Mom and Dad. They're just ashes. When you're dead, you're gone, I whisper. No one hears. Peter and my sister discuss dates for the interment of the ashes. Peter explains what to expect on the day. The grave will be dug, but covered, of course. A table is provided to hold the box of your brother's remains. You can have someone else inter the box later, or you can do it. Peter doesn't pause for a breath. You can also fill in the grave yourself if you want, or, he inhales deeply, I'll just say the word and the diggers will magically appear from the shadows with their shovels. My sister and I lock eyes. Do you need a deposit now, or do we pay in full on the day? My capable sibling asks. Peter leans back in his chair and unbuttons his jacket. Oh, full payment up front. We are a Catholic cemetery. We don't trust anyone. He doesn't laugh. I don't laugh. My sister is startled. Are you a practicing Catholic, Peter? I ask. He ignores the question. When we are done, Peter hands us a map of the cemetery with directions to the family plot. Things have changed since the last time you were here, he reiterates. He circles section 21, fifth row. My sis and I leave the office to find the grave. We drive slowly, looking for the section 21 marker. It's not visible and we drive past it. By this time, I'm just angry. Angry at all these deaths, at Peter's performance, at not finding the damn grave site. We back up. Just park here, I'll be back. I grab the umbrella and tromp over graves, over souls with names and dates stamped in stone, apologizing, looking for my surname. I find it and signal to my sis. The two of us hunch under the umbrella in the pouring, pissing rain. The gravestone seems to have been planted, Terry Gilliam style, between two decrepit cedars. My sister has endured so much hardship during our brother's illness. These unkempt cedars are like a shot of spit in her face. She starts to rip out the dead branches, swearing she'll be back with her own pruners. Enough. I look away and face a beautiful hillside of green. Between us, though, is a ragged sea of gravestones with dollar signs notched into them, many with borders and embellishments. We drive out and home. I'm feeling good about this. Relieved, says my older, only sister. It's closure for him and us. I just want his name to be here so someone knows he was once alive. His children, grandchildren, and two wives know this. We know this. I don't really agree, but I'm here to support her. The whole thing is just too creepy, I mutter. My sister is quiet for a moment and then says softly, I think I'm better at these things than you are. We have been working on establishing a relationship since my brother's death, trying to close the 10-year gap between us. I'm surprised by this honesty, but totally agree with her. I glance at her profile as she drives. She's had a tougher life than me, her alpha to my omega. I place my hand on her shoulder. Thanks. She places her hand on top of mine. The rain weeps down the car windows.
That was Sue Bracken reading her story, Section 21. This concludes Life Rattle number 1352. My name is Lori Callis. I had the pleasure of recording Sue reading her stories. Life Rattle was created by Arne Ackman and Guy Allen. Be sure to tune in next week to hear more new stories.